Welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. Another week of hands-on financial education this week. Here with my buddy Ryan. What's happening, man?
Sometimes we teach passive income stuff, and sometimes we teach things that maybe you decide, wait a minute, I don't want to be active, I want to be passive, and so you get more excited about that. But sometimes we teach things about single-family rentals. If you want to get into single-family rentals, you want to build a portfolio, and you're like, I listen to Passive Income Pilots, and I learned some things about that, but where do I go get more education on how to buy tax liens, how to buy rentals, how to buy flips, right? We're going to drop some knowledge on people that have nothing to sell you. They're just literally doing it out there, executing for a number of years, good friends with Tate. And we wanted to bring them onto the show. They're also husband and wife.
Yep.
So there's that dynamic of doing business with your spouse and what goes on with that and how they manage responsibilities in day-to-day. We talk about the end of the show. So Tate, who do we have coming on?
So today we have Brad Hilton and Aubrey Carlson. They are an amazing couple. They live in San Diego, both with flying backgrounds. Aubrey is a badass naval aviator, retired now. And Brad has about 700 or 800 hours. We've known each other for 20 plus years, post-college friend who almost went to the airlines, took a hard left turn, went real estate. And they have built an incredible short-term rental portfolio. I've been following their journey for many, many years. You know, they're humble on the show, but it's pretty incredible how they've both rolled up their sleeves and done a lot of the hands-on work on a lot of these properties. And they are the king queen of short-term rentals.
And as a bonus, we're going to learn about the unique way that Tate used to transport himself to the airport.
That's right. Well,
it's a surprise.
Really from within the airport, you know, park over there, get to the hangar. Exactly.
That's right. I'll give you a hint. It's either a bicycle, a unicycle, or a skateboard. You can guess. Oh, I should have thrown like a car or something into that too. No, if you're looking for that professional rep status, if you're looking for doing something, if you're looking to get involved with your spouse in business and do something together that produces income and provides you with a huge tax incentive, this episode is for you. If you're looking at buying your first rental property, let's get into the show and let's learn how it's done.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Brad and Aubrey, welcome to the show, finally.
I was stoked to be here, man. Glad we finally made it happen.
Yes, very stoked.
Absolutely.
We get so many questions about building short-term rental portfolios. I'm stoked to have you guys talk to this. I literally get calls all the time when they're just somebody's trying to buy their first rental property. And it's like, holy cow, we haven't covered that on the show. Like we've got to go like down into the details and no better place to do it. So
probably because it's not passive.
Yeah. It is not passive. That's right.
Yeah. Well, we'll change the show to Not Passive Income Pilots.
That's right. Yeah. If anybody wants to complain in the show reviews that, you know, this isn't about passive investing. Well, it's not always about passive investing. But if you've been listening to the show, you know that there's only really a few solid games in town for offsetting W-2 income. One is investing in oil and gas. One is getting real estate professional status by doing more work in real estate than you do in your W-2. And we've got episodes on that. You can go back. That is the gold standard if you can get that. But there's this other thing that is short-term rentals. So if you buy a property and you operate as a short-term rental, which means your average length of stay is less than 7 days or 7 days or less, I can't remember for the life of me, that means the IRS does not consider it a passive activity like it does normal real estate. So usually your real estate losses can't go to offset your W-2 income unless it's a short-term rental. So if you go out, you buy that short-term rental, you manage it yourself for at least 100 hours per year and more than anybody else, you can take the bonus depreciation, do the cost segregation, all that fun stuff for the current year. So Brad and Aubrey, you guys have been building a short-term empire over the last few years. Brad, you and I met long ago. You want to tell a story about how we met? I want to talk about your backgrounds first and how you got into all this, and then we can get into the nuts and bolts of short term.
Yeah. So must have been 13, maybe 16 years ago.
I think it was
13 years old.
I don't want to age myself, but I think it was about 20 years ago.
Oh, you might be right because,
20 years ago?
That's crazy. I was bartending in PB and I met this gentleman and he was a pilot. And I was like, oh man, I've always wanted to do that. That's so cool. He's like, hey, well, I got a guy that's going to go do, you know, a run. You should just come and, you know, come down to the airport, take a ride with him. I was like, all right, cool. So we go and we fly for like an hour. I don't exactly remember what we did with that one, but I come back, we're at the hangar and he's like, oh, there's another guy that's about your age that's flying. Like, you should meet him. His name's Kate. I was like, oh, cool. Like, we should, you know, introduce us sometime. And literally, as he says that, Kate comes by on his skateboard, running by the hangar. And he's like, hey, Tate, meet Brad. And Tate, I think the first thing he asked me, he's like, oh, do you skate? And I was like, yeah, I grew up skating. So he tossed me a skate, skated around a little bit. And then he's like, hey, I'm going for a flight right now. You want to go? And I was like, yeah, absolutely. And then I just hopped on a plane with Tate and we became, you know, best buds since then.
Tate, do you skateboard to the airport? Is this a thing?
No, I have a one wheel now. But it doesn't get much use. Now, this was when I was living in San Diego. I had a longboard skateboard, and that was like the usual transportation to the bars. And I was flying bank checks up to LA from San Diego four nights a week in a Cessna 182. And I had the keys to the hangar, and it was the best job ever. I mean, sunset bank flight checks. Up to LA every night. Whew. Bank checks. It could have been drugs.
I haven't heard that in a while.
Yeah, I don't know. All I know is that a guy in a Toyota Yaris would drop off a bag of what I assumed were bank checks four nights a week, and I would fly them to LA. So
yeah, it was wild because I remember you just the story. Like, had a bunch of bags. You handed it to some dude on the tarmac, and we turned around. I was like, whoa.
That was back in the day when you know the interest that the banks would have to pay overnight because of these checks not clearing was more than the cost to fly them to, you know, for anybody listening to this show, there's a lot of you that probably remember these days, but for the younger guys and gals out there, you might not remember this, but it used to be a thing.
What was the name of that airline that did that, that you could get hired at? It was like, it was an overnight check operator. And,
right.
I can't remember. Obviously it's not NetJets, but it was like something like that, where you could get like Beechcraft time.
You,
is that what you
it
flew?
Is the thing.
Oh.
No, it was a Cessna 182. But it was nice. It was brand new, leather seats. It had XM radio. It was nice.
Man. Big balling. So no more overnight checks, right? That's not a thing anymore, is it?
I don't think so. People have to build time doing aerial surveys now.
Yep.
In any case, Aubrey, I'm excited to get to your background. But since we're on Brad, you want to talk more about your flying background before you got into real estate?
Yeah. So after that flight with you, I was trying to figure out how I could go fly. And I heard through the grapevine that I could join ATP, you know, and so it kind of took me a little while to figure that one out. And once I got my funds in a row or saved up to go join ATP, I was going to kind of do the, I think it's like you pay it off once you've gotten through the school, something like that. But anyways, I go through and I get my private rating, or I'm just about to get my private rating. And they were sucking through instructors so fast at that point that I think I had four instructors right before I was going to take my very first check ride. And none of them knew what the other one had taught me. And I went and did this check ride. So we learned in San Diego, and they had me go take my check ride in Hawthorne in LA, which I'd never flown in ever.
Oh my God.
So,
except for me in the bank checks at night, and we took off in the opposite direction.
So, thinking about that now, having students going through check rides, like that's, I mean, utterly insane to me looking at it. So, I was already set up for failure, and I didn't even make it through the oral part of it. I had some wild questions that didn't, I think we went over this a long time ago, Kate. He asked me, like, where the National Weather Station was located for all of the U.S. weather reporting. One of my first questions.
This.
And I was like, I don't even know that now.
I don't know that. Ryan, you consulted for the FAA. What's the answer to that?
Yeah, you got me.
I don't know either.
No, I think it's too bad because, like, you know, I've had extensive work working with people from FAA and at the headquarters, and they're the most amazing people ever. actually. They're very reasonable and practical. But man, you get those rogue inspectors in the field and like you just never know what you're going to get. And they can be on power trips and it could be real. I mean, there's great ones too, but there's also ones that you're just like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, you know, what is the weight of the battery? You know, things that, and right. Heck, we have this in the sim instructors too. When you're going through your sim training at the airlines, you've got, before AQP was like widespread, you'd get these like wild questions, like stump the dummy, as they say, where it's just a question that they know you don't know the answer to. So you're going to, they just want to fail you. So they're just deciding to fail you. Right. So
yeah.
It's terrible.
That's kind of what it was that. Yeah.
That my first check ride in a helicopter is that we lost our engines. We did a full auto rotation into a cornfield, by the way.
Holy cow. That's crazy. That's
amazing.
He flew that because we're like, okay, we're going to die if I do this. So.
All right, Aubrey. I'm excited to get into your background. You've got an incredible aviation background. Let's hear it.
Okay. Well, I graduated college in 2013, ROTC from the Navy, or Navy ROTC, and then went down to flight school in Pensacola in 2013 and became a helicopter pilot. And then after flight school in Florida, I've actually been in San Diego Station in San Diego ever since and flew MH-60 Romeos out of San Diego and did a couple deployments. And met Brad right at the end of my fleet tour, meaning like right after I did a couple deployments and was gone for a long time. So we met at the time. And yeah.
So you were flying Blackhawks and Brad's flying Cessnas. You want to talk a little bit about your Navy experience being a female and balancing, you know, that whole dynamic? And I want to hear more about this auto rotation into a cornfield too.
Yeah, an Alabama cornfield. Honestly, I was very lucky because a lot of my core group of girlfriends, we all went to flight school together. And then once I got to flight school, there was actually a lot of ladies there. And so I never really experienced that much. Yeah, there's like stories here and there, but it really didn't have much of an impact on me and any of my girlfriends. And we're still all really close today because we had like a core group from like starting from day one until like literally we're all best friends now. And I think that's a big difference. If you're, you know, I have a lot of lady jet friends who fly jets, and it is a very, very different experience. Actually, I love to brag on this because it's like literally my best friend. We were just in Vegas last week gambling together. She was the first female Top Gun instructor ever. And
nice.
So,
incredible.
Yeah. Right. Which was only a couple years ago, which is wild to think about. She's a backseater. And then one of her close girlfriends, they went through the same time, or right after her. So she was the first pilot female and Top Gun instructor. They went through that together. Thank God they had each other. Just being in that environment is helicopters and jets are just very different communities and cultures. And that is mainly due to men.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Nice.
Amazing. Well, and so Brad, you chose not to go to the airlines. Aubrey, you were transitioning out of the Navy, and how'd you get into real estate?
Well, I think we kind of almost dumb luck found into it because we were going to move into it together. And then what we were looking at the time, the rents were going up so high, and Aubrey has nice taste. And so she's like, oh, let's move into this place or that. And
everything I was sending him was like $5,000 a month.
Jesus, like, why don't we just buy something? And we didn't really know that we were just like
knew nothing.
In a perfect time to buy something during COVID, you know, at these low interest rates. And so we found a house that was cheaper to buy than it was to rent. And because she has the VA loan, you know, we essentially got paid to buy the house. And so it was just this giant win. And at the same point, we'd found this community that does a lot of real estate. We just take knowledge, accelerator course that kind of you're interested in, you know, getting into it. We kind of honed in on that too. At the same time, we just purchased a house and it just kind of led us down this path to kind of figure out what we wanted to do.
Yeah, it was it's a military specific like investor course that we did and it just opened our eyes. So like we bought this house just by accident, honestly, and just by dumb luck.
Yeah. Right. Amazing. Was that a short-term rental or how did that unfold?
So we bought a fixer-upper right next to the beach in San Diego in Ocean Beach. And it was on the market for like 45 days during COVID. We were searching for 6 months. We put in like, 7 offers, 8 offers? never got anything, and then just found this one. And so we had a lot of fixing up to do. And that was also at the time when San Diego was their short-term rental regulations. They were going to we're going to eliminate all short-term rentals. Like, everyone was freaked out and scared. So our initial thing was it was going to be a long-term rental. But once it came out, they're like, oh, we have this permit, and we applied for a permit and we got one. Everyone got one, by the way, because it's just not that many people apply for permits, apparently. So we got one. We're like, oh, shoot. Okay. This is happening. And so that was kind of by accident, too. It was never our intention.
Can I go back just a second? There's two things I wanted to kind of click into. One, you said something about because it was the VA loan, it didn't cost us anything. Can you kind of, for someone who's thinking about going into the military and investing, or somebody who's not in the military, can you kind of explain what that means?
Yeah. So you zero money down. And the nice thing about the VA loan, it has higher debt to income ratio requirements. So like the regular conventional, I don't know, you guys probably know better, it's probably 60% debt to income ratio or 50%. But
yeah, usually 50.
Yeah, 50. And
so
then,
and the VA lets you go higher?
Yeah, it goes up to 70 or 75. I don't know the exact, but it's way higher. So you can qualify for a way better house. And they got rid of the cap, so which is huge in San Diego, because this house was $790,000. We could barely afford it. And all we did was put our earnest money down, just $6,000 or something like that. And then zero money down. And then we did some negotiating because it was a fixer upper. So there were some plumbing issues. There's some other things. So at the closing table, we got $10,000 back. They paid us for those seller credits.
Yes. We just,
incredible.
We got paid to buy the house.
Yeah. But then once we got it, they were oh, wow. We paid a lot of money to fix it up.
And while you're in service too, don't you get a stipend monthly that goes towards housing in addition to that, or are you not in the service at that point?
Yeah. So then that's the BAH, and that's tax-free money. So that's really nice. And in San Diego, it's really high. So depending where you live, you get more income. So in San Diego, you're making way more money than you're living in Texas. So
I mean, this is huge, right? Because I talk to military men and women all the time who get the VA loan, and then they get a stipend for living expense at the base, in their respective area. And I think it's so fascinating, because usually when we think about real estate and think about this being part of your portfolio, we talk about the 10-30-30-30, right? 10% of your net worth should be in liquid or reserves, where you have that just kind of sitting around. Then 30% goes into the market, managed money, stocks, bonds, mutual funds. Then the next 30% goes into real estate or hard assets that you control. And then maybe the last 30% goes into a syndication or something, money that maybe you don't have as much control over. It's not as liquid. So when you get to this 30% bucket of real estate, you're not even putting really up much of your own money in this scenario, because you're literally getting 100% financed loan for the real estate. And then you're also getting some sort of living stipend on top of that to pay for it. And then I know a lot of military folks will have it as a rental, so they have roommates, right? So what an awesome hack. And then you basically end up with this house with some equity in it at the end of your duty station, at the end of your tour at that base. And then you've got this property. And I just think that's such an awesome way to do it. But I think education wise, you said you took a class, and I would love to see what is that class? Because I know I don't have Bigger Pockets is a great venue or things like that, but it sounds like you had a military specific course that kind of walked you through that. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Yes. And the reason we found this class and this guy who runs it is actually via podcast. And we were just listening to it one day. He was on there. I would love to plug them because they're amazing. He's actually him and his wife are really good friends of ours now. But White Feather Investments, they do this accelerator, and it was 6 months, and you meet every single week and you have homework. So you literally learn you can go from zero, from literally knowing nothing to real estate to, then we were doing multiple rehabs all the way in Alabama, living in San Diego.
Tax liens. We bought 3 homes. We made offers on 18 different properties. It's wild. With zero to hero. Very cool.
They really throw you in it. But it's awesome because we are very actionable people, and I'm a high risk taker. Especially at the time, I was 29 or something like that. So in your 20s, you should be making risk. Financial risk.
Yeah.
I agree.
Absolutely. You know, Robert Kiyosaki always says, if you're going to go broke, do it before you're 40.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this is the time to do it. When you're in your 20s, this is when you take swings for the fences.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, you've got nothing to, you got no family, you've got, you know, very little responsibilities. This is when you do these things and you take these risks. Like, what a perfect time. I'd probably say my biggest regret is not taking as much risk when I was younger.
Same.
And I would go back and be like, hey, go figure out how to just go buy a house. You know, yeah. I mean, I would do it more intelligently now with all the podcasts and trainings and webinars that you guys took. But we'll put a link to that in the show notes. If you're right, you know, for those that want to take that accelerator, we're not promoting it or anything, but, you know, just as a, you know, it worked for these guys. So it could work for you or not,
yeah.
You know, depending on how much action you take. And I love that you said that, because a lot of people take all this training and all these classes and they sit and they do nothing. And that's really annoying, right? You guys actually went out and, hey, we're going to pull some triggers and try this out. How'd it work out?
Full circle to that right now is that podcast that we listened to that linked us to that guy's course. We are sitting in his podcast studio right now recording this, and he's our partner.
That's crazy.
As well on multiple deals. So it's come full circle.
And we didn't know it. Like,
we didn't know.
Someone just sent me his podcast.
Yeah.
And we just started listening to it. And now he's our business partner. And we're seeing his podcast, what, 5 years later?
Yeah, we're sitting in his studio right now.
Like, it's just crazy. But that's because we took
that. That's so cool.
Yeah.
Brad, I know that you know, had a bit of a setback with failing your private check ride, but you didn't stop there. You kept going.
No.
I want to talk about the decision to pivot, because we had a lot of beers together back in, you know, 2017, 18, 19.
We did.
I was mentoring you through the process, and you got to get in. There's about to be a hiring wave, and it would have been a good time to get into the airlines, right? But you made a conscious decision not to. Can you talk about that decision? Like, why did you decide not to pursue the airlines?
Yeah. You know, sometimes I think back on that, and it's kind of a serendipity, right? I had a setback, and then so dropped out of that school. I found my private instructor and then went all the way through, got all my ratings. And I got up to when I met Aubrey. Well, maybe not when I met Aubrey, but I was about like 700-800 hours when I started to realize that maybe this isn't the path. And it was just kind of I met a woman that I realized I would want to spend, you know, most of my time with and my life with. So that kind of starts to, I try to think of like, what was future Brad going to want to do? Is he going to want to be gone? Is he not going to want to be gone? And then this other job fell into my lap at the same point during COVID that gave me a giant boost in what we could now purchase. And we also hit really well on that first house. We saw how much we could make. We like turbocharged. We were able to buy more houses with it. We were able to cash flow with it. We were able to just like all the doors open at once. And I kind of had this decision point. And I remember like I was teaching a student to land once and my head was just like, hey, I got to get this door fixed for a rental. And I'm like, I can't do all these at once, man. Like this isn't good. This kid needs to learn how to land. And I'm fully focused like in my phone. Like, oh, we'll be all right. Like, well, we can't bounce that many times. We'll be good. But I was like, I need to make a decision right now, you know? And so I've come from a background of owning my own business, you know, before. And so I just trust myself that I know that it'll work out. And so that was one of the reasons that I just kind of went that way. And then also it helped that Aubrey's such a badass pilot and her friends are, that I get to live a lot of it vicariously through them of being Top Gun instructors. And, you know, they also flew like Tom Cruise around for the new Top Gun movie. And it was just like,
that's right.
I get a little bit of that taste of it. Now, do I still look in the sky every time a plane goes overhead and think about my decision? Yeah. But, you know, I think we're in a spot that within a couple of years, I'll be able to kind of realize all this hard work we put in. And I think it'll give me even more freedom, even more time. And then I can go back to teaching if I like, or just, you know, buy a plane and fly around. Like, I think there's a lot of things that'll open up, especially since we want to have kids. So that was another decision that.
Yeah.
My parents were gone a lot when I was growing up. So I thought, you know, I kind of want to be around a little bit more, I think. So, but I know that if you hit it right in an airline, you can stick around. You don't have to do much as far as like, you don't
That's
have to
true.
Be as gone as you want to be, or you might hear.
Yeah,
might
but
be.
It's a long road.
It is.
Yeah, for sure. And that actually feeds back to the idea of taking risks while you're young, right? And, you know, a lot of people spend those time at the regionals and move around and have to go, you know, relocate to a base on the East Coast or somewhere else that from where they're from for a number of years to build their hours. So, and that's certainly easier to do when you're in your 20s than it is when you're in your 30s. So
many pilots like wonder, like, Ryan, can I follow you around for the day? Can I follow you around for the day and just see what you guys do? Because you guys are talking about, hey, I didn't go the airline career. I went a different way. I went this completely different way. But Tate and I didn't do that, right? We actually went, and I actually started a real estate company, an operator. Tate started a fund. And I literally, on this bus tour in Houston, I had a FedEx pilot come up to me and say, I'm so curious as to what you guys do every day, because it's so different than what we do, right? We go, we fly the plane, and we take care of our passengers, and we do that. But what you guys are doing is so different. Can you kind of just walk through, like, at a high level, maybe zooming into details, like, what is your week like? Like, what do you walk us through, like, what you work on, maybe how you time block, you know, things like that.
Well, I'm full-time running our business. So I don't have any other job besides that, which was always my number one of getting out of the military. I'm like, I don't want to write a resume. So my daily life is way different than Braz, because he still works on the boat. We're just on a boat right now. So he just helps me when he can. But me, I'm just fully focusing on our short-term rental business, and we do interior design, and we do our own rentals. So I'm constantly just putting out fires all the time. And then I'm also doing interior design. So like I do, you know, I'm working with a primary home. We're redoing his kitchen. And then I'm also working on this $250,000 interior design job in Pacific Beach, like stuff like that. So it just kind of wide range. And then I'm also running between the rentals and like fixing stuff and working with cleaners.
Nice.
And you're doing a huge renovation in Julian. So Julian, California is up in the mountains. You've sent me photos. I want to talk about the first property that you did. Brad, you were up there doing geometry from like high school geometry, you know, figuring out how to run cables on your new staircase. I think you said you were just brushing concrete earlier today. I mean, yeah. Like, I want to dig into to the short-term rental stuff, right? How do you find these properties? How do you figure out how to design them? Where do you get the materials? How do you manage the contractors? What work do you do yourselves? I know I'm throwing a lot at you, but that's what I'm trying to tease out is, you know, share with our listeners and inspire them in terms of how they can find and build and create something that somebody's going to want to go and spend some money to go stay in at for a weekend, right?
Yeah, we can touch on how we found that market first, because there's a lot of tools we use for that. Like, so Julian, the market specifically you're talking about, it's a mountain town an hour east of San Diego. And the great thing about the location, it's an hour east from San Diego. So there's a population of what, like, there are like 5 million people around in San Diego County. And then there's also LA's 3 hours. You know, there's millions and millions of people there. So you're within a couple hours, you have millions and millions of people. You're like, okay, if this is the right property, you make it unique. We have this pool of people. So yeah, we look at the revenue. We look at AirDNA. We look at Airbnb. We find all the numbers and we want to see what's possible. We're like, okay, what's the best property? What is it doing? I'm like, okay, so the best property out there is making $120,000 in gross revenue. Let's see what it looks like. And then we're like, okay, this makes a lot of sense because these houses are way cheaper than San Diego. And, you know, $120,000 in San Diego in gross income is really good, but the houses in San Diego are worth $1 million. Like, okay, well, we can buy this house for $600,000, you know, put some money into it, make it really, really unique. And first of all, buy a unique house, you know, that has a view. And those numbers just work out way, way better. And you have a population of millions of people that you can pull from to get there. So like making the house itself a destination was kind of the whole point of it. And then now that area is, there's just a lot of nice Airbnbs popping up in there. So it's like it itself is becoming a destination, everything like that. So we just kind of like saw it early in the potential of that market, of it just being this beautiful place that no one really knew about. And then now it's just kind of on the map. We bought another.
So it was a kind of a cabin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a cabin.
With a beautiful view. Mm-hmm. What did you do to it? Like, tell us about the renovation.
So the renovation on that one was it was kind of like an old grandma style cabin where everything was wood, Formica countertops. You know, there it's something it, they, these people that had it before were definitely, you know, late 70s, probably 80s. So it was very grandma feel. But in order to be unique and stand out, when you start looking at the Airbnbs that are successful in that area, you want to stand out. And so it's like, okay, let's make this modern. Let's not only redo all the floors, but let's take out the banister rails and put in nice new metal ones. Let's redo the full kitchen. You know, some of the master baths, ROI for redoing that. We decided to do both bathrooms. We did a ton of landscaping. We did repainted the outside, the deck. It's, you know, 2,400 square feet. So it's a massive house. So like every surface had to be retouched, redone, you know, all new. Essentially anything you can think of was new, but we didn't tear it down to the studs. We just kind of, you
there's know. No studs. It's a log cabin.
Yes, yeah, a log cabin.
Right. So for someone who may not have a design eye like you are, where you do interior design, where did you go for some of the inspiration on the design elements?
So how I do all my interior design inspo is, so I walk through the space and then, okay, this is what I'm working with. And then I look at all of the competitors on Airbnb, VRBO, like, okay, what are they putting out there in the world? How are they doing? And so we look at the market and kind of see the gap. Like, okay, what's the gap? No one has a cedar hot tub. Okay. And cedar hot tubs are more expensive than regular hot tubs. But that was the smartest decision we ever made, because every single review, every person is like cedar hot tub. So the ROI on this $12,000 hot tub, huge. And you can also see the ROI on hot tubs in general if you look at properties with hot tubs, without hot tubs in that market. So then I kind of look at that and I'm like, okay, I get the feel of where I want to go. And then I go on Pinterest and I just create mood boards and mood boards and mood boards of where I want this property to go, get an inspiration on Pinterest, on Instagram, and kind of build out the feel of the house. And then from there, I go and shop for the stuff. So Pinterest is huge, and Instagram.
Now you've nailed it two different ways. The first thing that you spent a lot of time on explaining was the market dynamics, right? You first kind of hit it as, I know that pricing is better over here. I know where the market's going. I know that the affordability is different. And then you did something really important, which is you went to your competition and you basically said, okay, what's working in this market? And let's do what's already working. It's not like you went out and had to completely reinvent the wheel. I mean, I'm sure you're very creative and everything, but more importantly is like, what is already working? Like, you don't want to go to a market and just blindly do something in a property that, oh, I think this will work, and then it doesn't. Why not just go make what works, right? And maybe be slightly different, but really just kind of do what works. So I think this is really important. Like, it sounds like you're investing in your local market, which, you know, which if you're a new real estate investor, especially, sometimes investing in your backyard makes a ton of sense to start.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because invest where you know. My very first property I ever purchased for purposes of investing literally was right next door to me. Right. My second real estate property I ever bought was five doors down. So my first four flips were like literally on my block, because I knew the area, I knew the demographics, I could walk the streets, I could be by the property. And I think that's just really smart that you not only invested in your kind of your backyard or what you really knew and were familiar with, but also you took leads from, you know, what other people had already done successfully. So I just really want to underscore that.
Definitely. And if I can say, you know, if you aren't going to buy something right next door, at least buy it in a place that you want to spend time. Like Julian's a beautiful area.
Yeah.
You know, it's a long drive from San Diego, you know, an hour, hour and a half, but it's a nice area. I'm sure you guys are excited to go out there. You know, I made the mistake of buying a property on the East Coast when I was between the West Coast and Hawaii, and it's just super difficult. It's not how I want to spend my time. Is flying all the way to the East Coast and then stay in a hotel to manage, you know, to do work on this property. And so just don't buy a property in a place that you don't want to spend time.
Like Palatka, really, Florida, Tate? Is that like that one?
Like Palatka, Florida. Yeah. No, that property's been great.
No, it's been good. It's funny. Tate and I think crashed in a Best Western together in Palatka, Florida, and then went to a pretty good dive bar next door when we were buying self storage property. It was pretty good.
That's right.
Anyway, I wanted to kind of, you know, underscore that too, because like, I think people go cheap right? And so they go really far away to some very unknown market and buy some very obscure property that's affordable and looks good on paper. And those are usually recipes for disaster. And so I just want to underscore that. Like sometimes you, oh, I got to buy something cheap in Detroit. And you're like, I don't want to go to Detroit. I mean, I like going to Detroit for football games. But, you know, outside of that, like you're not going there and spending time and you don't even know the streets and the blocks and the, you know, and there's, right. There might not be, it might be cheap and it might look great, but be really careful about that stuff. It's so important.
Totally.
Yeah.
Aubrey, the next thing you said was, then I go buy the stuff. So what are you buying? I want to talk about, you know, Wayfair Pro and Home Depot and Minoan and like, where do you source all this stuff?
Yeah, well, Minoan's a huge one. So that's where you can get all the trade discounts, like, you know, hundreds of stores. So if you own one,
yeah, we'll link to that in the show notes because you turned us on to Minoan when we were furnishing our short-term rental and we saved at least $10,000, if not 15 or even more. It's crazy. You get these quotes. Mm-hmm. You can speak to it more than I can.
Yeah, it's amazing. So every week, I feel like they bring more and more partners on. They did lose Pottery Williams Sonoma, which is Pottery Barn, West Elm, blah, blah, blah. But then I just ended up getting a trade account with Williams Sonoma. So then I can still get those discounts, but directly through Williams Sonoma. So then you can still go to Pottery Barn and get the 20% off. But
okay, what about all the construction materials? Then what do you roll up your sleeves and do? Brad, I know you were doing a bunch of manual labor on that house versus contractors. We talked before the show about what contractors do and what they don't. You want to talk through that?
Yeah. So when we go through each one of these properties, we'll get, you know, 2 to 3 different bids on everything, different contractors, especially out in Julian. Everything just costs more because most of the guys you're going to find are going to come from the city to come out there. So they're going to charge a little bit more. And then I just kind of line item what they're at on each one and see if any one of those is an astronomical price that I can do myself. And so a lot of that ended up being the landscaping for whatever reason.
Astronomical price.
Like, you know, like to do a 2-car parking spot just to clear it and not even put like asphalt was they're asking like $23,000 to, and I was like, for what? Like, that's crazy. So things like that. I'm like, I like working with my hands. I can do that. If you guys are doing the technical stuff, I'm not going to touch the electrical. I'm not going to touch the plumbing. I'm not going to touch anything that is out of my pay grade enough that if it goes wrong, it's a $10,000 fix, then I don't touch it.
Right.
Like landscaping, you know, it's like you can just fill a pothole. It's not that big of a deal. So it's a very high reward with very low risk. And so I try to touch those things. Like all the painting that we can do, we'll try to paint everything. It's a pain, but you know, those are the things that, you know, you might get a bid for $10,000 of paint. And it's like, well, I could come up for a couple weekends and paint for $10,000. That's fine.
We just kind of really look at the price.
And keep in mind that if you're going for real estate professional status, this all counts as material participation. And if you're going just for that one STR, you need 100 hours of managing and getting that thing set up, right? So that all counts. Yep.
So I would, then the things that we would bid out, you know, I've learned now, put it this way, that if you can get one contractor to do most of the work, it makes it way easier than getting your electrician, then getting your countertop guy, then getting your floor guy. If one guy can do most of that, then he's kind of the GC that's going to manage that whole schedule. And you can come to him with multiple things that are wrong and be like, hey, I noticed this. The window's crooked, the floor's off, blah, blah, blah. And he's already got that list of subs that he's hired out that he's going to then be in charge of because it's his bid. I've learned that if you chop it up and be like, oh, okay, I get a floor guy and then I get a paint guy and then I get this, then I got to manage, you know, start 6 different people all at once. And you're the guy that has to do the quality assurance on everything versus somebody else. So you start kind of learning as you go, what's worth your time and what isn't worth your time. And then I just kind of tick away at the things that I know I can do, you know, 90% of what another guy can do. And yeah, that's pretty solid for a short-term rental.
How do you find that good contractor that can actually do all those, manage all those things well?
We have yet.
Yeah. I mean, even when we do it.
All right, there's the truth.
Hey, you guys, you heard
it here. You hear it here. How do you find a good trunk? How do you? We haven't found one yet. Yeah, good point. I guess. Yeah, I mean, I don't want to turn this into a general contractor selection show, but
right,
you know, it is really important. I think kind of my philosophy on it is like, if you're a general contractor, you should be online. You should have reviews. You should have more than 5 or 10 people at your business. If you're Joe in a truck, like you're going to be Joe in a truck when things go bad and you're going to be hitting the road going to the next town. So if you are online and you have good reviews and you're searchable and you're findable, then I like that, right? Yeah. I'm not talking about, you know, overpaying for a high-end home services company, but just kind of that middle of the road where you're not the cheapest, but you're not the most expensive, but you actually have a reputation to uphold. That's really important in my selection process. You're not going to like my bad Google review, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. Versus like Joe in a truck, he doesn't care.
Yeah, he doesn't care.
He's got plenty of work. He'll find some other sucker to, you know, take
100%.
Take to the cleaners, right? So,
yeah. Aubrey, let's talk more about the design and build out process. You turned us on to a cool software called Spoke. I want to talk about that. You have an empty space. Let's say you've done the renovations. The countertops are looking good. You've painted. Now, what about furnishings and art? Where you get all that stuff and how do you measure it out?
Yeah, well, I use Spoke for like design clients.
What is Spoke? Because people aren't going to know what that is.
It's like super, super easy, like a monkey can use it type of thing versus those other design softwares or floor planning softwares are very, very complicated. And I honestly, the reason I haven't even learned that yet as a interior designer, because I never went to school for this, is because I just don't have enough time because we're so busy. So maybe one day I'll learn how to use the really fancy stuff. But right now, the space planning in each room is very, very critical. Because if you go spend, you know, $2,000 on a couch and learn it doesn't fit with everything else because of the space, then you're going to return the couch. So like, oh my God, I measure like 5 times now because I do not want to return any furniture or have to like order new. Because that is, and especially if it's, you're kind of, you know, for the Reno property, you're living in Hawaii. So like, if you have to return something, like who's going to return it for you? You have to hire someone.
Yeah, we're back and forth.
Yeah. So
Spoke is really cool. We'll link to it in the show notes. It's basically just like a very basic CAD thing where you can do floor planning and you can, you know, look what the dimensions of something are and drag it around and move stuff around. It's cool. And then my other hack here is painter's tape. You just take blue tape and you mark up the floor.
I do that all the time. Yeah. And then in Spoke, I also create my rooms. And that's where I figure out, okay, is this all going to go together? So I take all the furniture, all the colors, all the flooring, you know, the wall colors, all the art, and I put it on that board and to see, you know, if one piece doesn't fit. Because honestly, like every board I've done, like you could see, it looks exactly like the room. So like, okay, this board, you know, has all this, the couch and the coffee table and all that kind of stuff and the colors. And then you see the room after and you're like, it looks very similar. So it is a really, really good way to figure out something goes with the space or doesn't go with the space. So
for anybody listening out there that's like, oh man, this sounds like a nightmare, but my spouse might be decent at this. We talked before the show about wanting to kind of go down this tangent of working with your spouse on something. And actually, this is something that Lucy and I have found that we work really well together. Ryan, I know that you and Jackie have worked together in the past, although in a more of a corporate setting within Spartan. Brad and Aubrey, what are some pros and cons of working with your spouse on a project like this?
I'll let Aubrey go first.
Yeah. Good, wise decision.
It is kind of tough because Brad does have this full-time job right now. So like when it's in the busy season of summer, I'm like, I feel like I'm pulling his attention away. I don't know. And then it's just constant. We're like constantly communicating. And we really have to kind of, you know, be in either work mode or not work mode. And that's really hard to do. Mm-hmm. And especially hard for an alpha female to do. And I've understood that like, then I have to, and, you know, we've talked to therapists about this. Like, I have to put myself in the beta, you know what I mean? Because as an alpha female, if you're always in the alpha mode, that's just like too masculine for the guys. You really have to like back yourself up and like, okay, we're not in work mode, date night, you know, and you like And what I've learned about being an entrepreneur too is like, no one else is going to schedule a date night or like vacation for me. Like I have to be very, very intentional about putting boundaries in place and, you know, booking that date night or booking that getaway for the weekend or the week or whatever. So we have to be really intentional about that, because otherwise then you just, it's just too much work on your coworkers.
Absolutely.
I literally have nothing to add to that. That was said so well. If you're out there working with your spouse and you know that Aubrey knows, like that is exactly how it goes. Literally. Yep. Like,
yeah, I feel the same way. I mean, Lucy and I both worked a 12-hour day yesterday. She's putting properties in escrow as we speak. We've got a triplex that we just bought. We have got a tree trimmer there this morning and the neighbors yelling at the tree trimmer. And we've got, you know, new appliances coming in and painters. And obviously I'm raising millions of dollars in turbine at the same time and communicating with investors. And it sometimes can be tough to switch off, you know, but for a lot of listeners out there, I think this is more, hey, I'm thinking about doing this because I want the tax write-off. I want to kind of keep this relatable to everybody listening to the show. Let's get in more to, you know, okay, you furnished the place. What are some pieces of software that you couldn't live without? What's next? How do you list the property? How do you photograph it? How do you get it live? Do you lean on Airbnb or the third-party management software platforms that you use? Talk us through that process.
Okay. So yeah, I have a huge software stack. And I mean, we own a short-term rental property management company, so we don't only do our own, we do other people's. But I will say from day one, the first property we listed was that Ocean Beach house. And I was like, okay, I had a goal in mind. I'm like, I want to build out this portfolio, whether it's our own or other people's or both. So I started doing the software very, very early, so it would be very easy to plug and play. So even though I had one property, I was like, I'm going to get a property management software. So I get Postfully, which, you know, and property management software, if you're doing one property, it's very expensive. You know, the more you get on, the cheaper it is per property. But I'm like, I want to be able to kind of really automate all this. So Postfully, which is amazing, incredible. So I mean, everything's automated. The only thing that's not automated in our business is the maintenance, which, you know, eventually we'll get there because I use Breezeway. So Hostfully and Breezeway are my top two. And Breezeway is...
Tell people about what those things are.
Yeah. So Hostfully is the property management software. And that's where I plug it in and it just does everything. And it's just the hub. So it does all the guest messaging. So I never have to send a message unless the guest like texting me, asking me for like, hey, something with the fridge or, you know, just something random. Otherwise, everything's automated with that. And it, you know, automates all the cleanings through Breezeway. So I bring Breezeway on to automate all the cleaners. So all of that's automated. And then I sync that with Price Labs and it syncs all the pricing on all the pricings, which is huge. I mean, pricing the properties, I mean, that is going to be one of the biggest things with revenue, the revenue management. It can be hard, especially if you're not, if we have like 11 listings right now. So I would have to individually go in there and look at every single week and weekend for every property, which would take me like all week.
Price Labs is worth its weight in gold. So essentially it's dynamic pricing software that works like hotels or airlines where, you know, it knows that it's a holiday weekend. And so it jacks up the price. It pulls all the data from all the hotels in the surrounding area and the hotel rates are going up. It mirrors that. And then you can set the floor rate. So you can say, hey, I don't care how dead it is. I never want to rent my property for less than X amount of dollars per night. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. So Breezeway, I hadn't heard of Breezeway. That's interesting. How did you find your cleaners? Because this is like the hardest thing. We've been through three. We finally found one we really like in our market.
Yeah. So I've used Turno in a lot of markets. Because Turno,
which used to be turnover.com. Yeah. And now it's Turno.
Yeah, and I used to use it for the cleaning automation, but then I switched to Breezeway because Breezeway also does the maintenance and does other things. So it has kind of like, I wanted to be able to put maintenance tasks in there. Anyways, especially when you get so many properties, you have to push a lot of maintenance. Anyways, so Turno has a marketplace. So what I can do is I can just plug in an address. And this is actually where I found a lot of my really, really reliable cleaners because we do have two properties in Alabama. And I found this lady on Turno. And a huge thing for me too is I reach out to them like, hey, send me all of the listings you clean, like send me your Airbnb listings that you clean. because that will tell you right there.
There you go. That's a good cleaner. That's a good tip.
So, because if there's like one thing, like just something like, oh, it was so dirty, you know, even one time, I'm like, no.
Yep.
Because you live and die by your
That's a great tip.
Yeah.
And 100%.
I think the art of asking for a reference is like 99% of your jobs as an entrepreneur.
Yep.
Is figuring out like how to assess good people to work for. And of course, anybody you ask for referrals is going to give you who they want to give you. So I think it's such a creative way to basically say, like, show me your work. And then like you search in the public domain for their, you know, for bad reviews or good reviews. And I think that's such a great way to do it. I just want to highlight that because I think it's understated when you're managing property remotely and you've got to rely on trades to come to your properties. Like, you have to make sure the person is really good and has a track record of being really good. And, you know, a referral might be okay, but doing your own due diligence is so critical.
I also want to highlight what Aubrey said about automated guest communications, because, you know, my wife, Lucy, manages our short term. It's part of our, you know, real estate professional status ecosystem that we have so that we can take all of our losses, real estate losses against W-2 income, including syndication losses. But a lot of people ask me, you know, I'll be flying with somebody and they're like, oh my God, isn't that just a ton of work? Well, it is on the front end because you have to write all of these. I mean, I think we have something like 15 automated messages that meter out when someone books 3 days prior to their stay, like a week prior, 3 days prior, the day of, after they've checked in, you know, all of these things like checking in. Hey, do you need anything? We usually don't send a single message to our guests when they're staying the entire time because everything is answered. You know, about 3 days out is where they're like, hey, we're going to this Airbnb. I haven't heard anything. Bam, they get a message. Hey, you can expect your check-in code. And your front door can link to Hostively or whatever property management system that you're doing. It sends them the communication. It programs the lock. I mean, all of this stuff. It takes a lot of work on the front end to get it automated, but once you have it automated, it's on autopilot. I mean, occasionally you get that text like, hey, the door isn't working. It's like, no, your finger isn't working. But
I wish I could say that.
You know, for the most part, it works flawlessly.
Yeah.
You build the system and then it just runs.
Yeah. And Hostfully, they have digital guidebooks. So it's this super cool digital guidebook and it has everything. I could put videos on how to use the front door lock. The house manual, and then it has all my recommendations. So like every coffee shop around the thing, they could click, they could call it, they could go to their Instagram. It literally has everything in there. And it's all digital. We just love software. So, and then what's great about the digital guidebook is, you know, coffee shops closing or stuff, or, you know, you add new stuff to your Airbnb or you add things or delete things, you can delete that in the guidebook versus having to print out a new one and put it in your property. So.
Love it.
All right. I got one last question because I know we're at time, but I really appreciate you guys coming on. So when is your class? When are you guys launching your class? When are you guys launching your training program?
I've never thought about that ever. And then Tate asked, like, oh, is there anything you guys like want to promote? And I'm like, no, I am so busy. You can reach out to me if you want, but like, I'm too busy.
I'm probably not going to respond to you. Yeah, I was gonna kind of lead into that. You know, how if listeners wanted to follow along on your journey, maybe they just want to follow you on Instagram or Facebook or something. How do the listeners get in touch with you?
Yeah, so our company is called Salt and Sky Lodging Co. So that's our interior design and our property management, and that's all at Salt and Sky Lodging Co. The handle on Instagram and then the website as well. So yeah, we post like design inspo and do a lot of interior design stuff and San Diego stuff. So. Fun.
Yeah, updates on all our processes.
Awesome.
We're going along the way. Mm-hmm.
Well, you guys are very humble because I've been following along for years. You've really rolled up your sleeves and dug in. So it's been impressive. So thanks for sharing this. Look forward to hearing more about your journey sometime soon. And very much appreciate the wisdom. I think people will get a lot out of it, especially if they're thinking about picking up a short-term rental sometime this year or next year.
Awesome. Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. Really honored.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much.
Take care, guys. Adios.
See ya.